Oh,
okay.
Okay. Welcome, everyone. Welcome to the University of Guelph and the people from out of town. There's a few of you here. And a sincere welcome to anyone who hasn't been to anything with the Office of Open Learning on behalf of Virginia Gray and myself. My name is Mike Hartrup, and we want to present to you Stephen Downs today. Stephen has been the senior researcher e-learning sector with the National Research Council since November 2001. If Stephen's OL Daily is a widely syndicated blog that's received on about 2,300 desktops daily. He has an enormous following, and in May 2004, actually, Blog Canada rated as one of the top 10 blogs for popularity and many different features that he was using. Stephen today will speak about the future of online learning and his vision and many different topics. But he has been a very strong advocate for community, democracy of learning, technology and education, and he has over about 100 published papers on his site, about 400 articles and commentary. There is ample information and areas of interest that tie in for anyone who's interested in online education and learning. Some of his peers speak very highly of Stephen's work. One fellow, Jeffrey Hibbert, who runs a blog called Headspace J, very strong at e-portfolios, has mentioned that he was reading Stephen's blog before it was even called a blog. Bill Muirhead, University of Ontario, states that Stephen's OL Daily fills gaps for very busy e-learning researchers who depend on timely information. Many say it's the first email or the last email that they read every day. Bill has also stated that Stephen will challenge us all to examine our beliefs about teaching and learning. He's widely traveled. He's a keen observer of current trends, and he never leaves an audience neutral. He'll raise many questions and answers. So you will hopefully be able to be engaged with that today. He will share his vision. And the other thing to set the stage today is a quote from one of Stephen's postings. He is very passionate about learning. He states, "Education for all, and through education, a path toward each of us achieving all that we hope and all that we dream for." So I'm going to welcome Stephen Downs, and please join me in looking forward to our conversation.
Well, thanks, everyone. As you probably noticed, I've got the recorder running, so everything you say will be held as evidence. It's a pleasure to be here, and it's very interesting for me to be here because a long time, well, almost 20 years ago now, I did my very first academic talk ever at the University of Guelph. It was the first Canadian graduate student conference in philosophy. I flew out here from Edmonton, and very young and very nervous, and I stayed at the Albion Hotel, which I saw is still there on the way in. And I looked at the hotel as we came and said, "Yeah, that's the place. It looks exactly like it did back then." Which I guess is a scary thought. I've sort of changed the name of the talk a wee bit because anytime I give a talk, it always reflects where I am, what I'm thinking about at the precise moment. So it's the living arts, the future of learning online. So I sort of held to the promise to talk about the future, but I'm still tying it into stuff I did yesterday. Now I want to, just as by way of preliminary, although I can, I prefer not to just get up here and talk for an hour and a half. And I'm pretty sure you guys don't want me to talk for an hour and a half. So I'm going to preface my remarks by saying, at any point whatsoever, if you have a comment, a question, a criticism, something to throw at me, please feel free to do so, except for the throwing part. And because you know, the idea of coming here to Guelph and giving a talk is you know, to have some interaction, to have some dialogue. When I came last time, when I came, I stood there in the podium and I talked, and both members of the audience listened attentively. Actually, it wasn't that bad. So it was a group of about this size, which is kind of interesting. So yeah, by all means, do contribute and ask questions and comment and so on. You're not required in any sense to agree with me. Please feel free to disagree. I encourage that. I'm certainly used to it. So, I mean, you're not going to insult me if you say, look, what you say is completely wrong. What you'll be doing is informing my view of the world and helping me with input and information, because I'm a very selfish person. And the reason why I do these talks is not so that I can go to neat places like Guelph, although that is part of it. But the reason why I do these talks is so that I can hear your comments and your opinions and your experiences, and that way it all gets filtered into the brain and usually shows up in links or whatever that I do later on. So that's the preliminary. Just a quick check. How many of you do read OL Daily? Fewer than half. All right, new subscriptions. I'm just kidding. I think my website address is on one of the slides later on. Okay. Were there any other preliminaries? Did I promise I was going to say anything else before I started?
Free subscriptions don't go on very hard.
Oh, well, they're always free. Okay. And if you do make a comment, please speak nice and loudly, because you are being recorded. And we want to be nice to the people listening online. They're not online right at the moment listening. It's not live, but it will be online later this afternoon. So, and they will want to be able to hear you. And if they can't, they'll complain to me. So, where do I want to start? I never know where I'm going to start. I was telling Mike it takes me about 20 minutes to get warmed up. So you guys can go and come back in 20 minutes. I'll still be talking. I actually did do a talk to an empty room once. It was the online learning conference they have in at Madison, Wisconsin. And it was about 2 years, 2.5 years, whatever. And I had a talk accepted. It was about blogs and RSS and content syndication, and I went there. I went all the way to Wisconsin, and they lost my luggage and all of that. Got there, empty room. So I gave my talk. And it's still on my website. Sadly, I didn't record it. It would have been neat. You know, okay, I'll pause for questions now. So I sort of have two threads running through my mind, which is why I'm not really sure where to start. One thread's the philosophy thread, because it was a philosophy talk that I gave in Guelph. And the other thread is the Mississauga thread, which I will come back to. The philosophy thread is something like this. It's been a thought that's been running through my mind just this morning. And that's Plato in Republic talked a lot about learning. He talked a lot about community and personal development. And one of Plato's ideas was that everybody, every person has some kind of role that they fill in society, something that they're good at. They have their own natural place, if you will. So, you know, some people, you know, ancient Greece. So some people are intended to be soldiers, and some people are intended to be politicians, and some people are intended to be millers or whatever they do in ancient Greece. And in addition to that, what Plato said was they don't know what their roles are. And so you need some sort of administrative system in order to sort people out. It's, you know, there's some director, right? Okay, you're a soldier, you're a miller, you're going to lead us all, or that sort of thing, right? Organize us all out. And I think Plato was partly right. The partly right bit is, I agree with him in the sense that everybody has some role in society. And when I translate that into contemporary society, and contemporary language, I'd say something like, everybody has some natural set of skills. Everybody has some sort of affinity. Some people are naturally ballet dancers. Other people are naturally hockey players. And it may be innate, it may be learned. I'm not going to come and do a theory of cognitive development because it's too early in the morning for that. You need at least 3 or 4 beers and a jazz band. But what I'm trying to get at is that there is a capacity that exists in people that is very often undeveloped, because they don't find their place in society. But where I disagree with Plato is in this idea that you need some archon handing out these roles. I think people can find this place for themselves, given the opportunity and the means to do so. As that I believe is the ultimate long-term promise of online learning, and why I'm very interested in this subject. So what, you may ask, does this have to do with Mississauga? You're probably asking that in Mississauga as well. Well, let's think about online learning for a sec. Think about the picture that you have. It almost certainly involves a computer, right? And it probably looks something like this picture here. You know, with one person, maybe two people, they must be doing team programming or extreme programming. There was somebody who tried to lure me into the cult of extreme programming, but I resisted. But the idea is, you know, online learning must be a person sitting in front of a computer, right? How else could you do it? It's certainly the image that's propagated out there in the media. I'm sure you've read the criticisms of online learning. Gee, if somebody spends all their time in front of a computer, how will they socialize? How will they live life? All of that. I don't believe that this is the picture of online learning. I never have believed that this is the picture of online learning. My view of online learning is that it is not going to tie us down to something like a computer or a classroom or anything like that, but rather it is going to free us from that. These shots are from Mississauga. And these shots represent what I believe is the future of online learning. Now, you notice there's no computer in these pictures. And in fact, what we have on the right, obviously, some children who want to be ballet dancers. And on the left, that's a handprint impressed in some glass. And the idea is that, well, no, how do I want to say this? I took these pictures at a place called the Living Arts Center in Mississauga. How many of you have, well, you've heard of Mississauga. Okay, good. How many of you have heard of the Living Arts Center? Pretty well everyone. Okay. You probably all know more about this place than I do. I discovered it yesterday. But it made for, and so I'm not going to speak with any authority about the Living Arts Center, but it makes a wonderful metaphor for the sort of thing that I'm trying to get at. Online learning is about getting students out of the classroom, getting them out of school, and getting them into places such as the Living Arts Center, where they can pursue whatever it is their passion is, whatever it is their natural abilities and affinities are. So that's the perspective that I'm coming from. The concept, therefore, in a nutshell, and this is part prediction, this is part recommendation. I think it's probably going to happen something like this, but I think it needs a push. The idea is that learning of the future will be centered around the interests of the learner, rather than centered around a curriculum or a standard program. And it's learning that is immersive. We take students out of the classroom and put them into an appropriate environment. And by appropriate environment, I mean a place where what they're learning about is to be found. The slogan that I use sometimes is, the best place to learn about trees is in a forest. And the idea here is, if the students are learning about trees, what online learning does for us is allow them to do so in a forest. Now you might think that's a really wild, far out kind of concept, and there's no real evidence to support the contention that this is the direction in which we are indeed moving. But I believe that there is evidence, and I have two groups of science importance, if you will. The first group centers around the concept of game-based learning. I'm assuming that most of you are familiar with a lot of the concepts of game-based learning, that it exists, and that the concept is that learning can take place in an environment such as a game. I was at CSTD in Fredericton last week, and Clark Aldrich was up there. He did a talk, and that's what the link is to my summary of his talk. The idea of games-based learning is that instead of interacting directly with learning content, such as a textbook, or an exercise, or an assignment, or a quiz, the learning content is in some way embedded in an interactive environment, which we, for lack of a better word, call a game. And Clark came up with a nice little taxonomy of types of online games that accords with my own experience, so I stole it, because I do that. Talking about branching games, spreadsheet games, game games, which seem to me a little redundant, and then labs. And these are fairly familiar groupings of games to people who are gamers, to people who have done work in online games. The branching game is the sort of game, you know, you're presented with a scenario, you're walking through the woods, you see a dog, what do you do? A, say hello to the dog, B, run away. And depending on how you choose, the game branches. And then it branches and branches and branches until you hit one of a dozen or whatever predetermined outcomes. One of the things gamers do very quickly is memorize that branch, that branching set. So these things become very easy to win. They didn't last long in the arcades. There were a few in the early days, but they eventually disappeared. More common is the spreadsheet games, which I find very interesting. Basically, the spreadsheet game is a game where you have multiple interacting variables. The example I use that I've had in my mind, I'm going to build this one day, and I've been saying this for 3 years, so is the online budget simulator. Now, which makes sense, a spreadsheet, right? But in the budget simulator, you have a set of variables for each part of the budget. I guess that's really appropriate these days. It didn't occur to me. I noticed you sort of giggle there. But that's right. It's been budget time recently. It didn't even occur to me. Oh, well. But the idea is a person working with the budget simulator inputs their own values. Allocate this much to the military. Allocate this much to roads. This much to schools, and so on. And then it becomes a game in the sense that you take those initial values and you run them again against a set of rules, where the rules describe how the variables interrelate with each other. And so if, for example, you put all of your budget into the military and you put none of your budget into hospitals, then you'd have... You run it through the rules and you discover you have a very heavily armed but very sick population. Okay, that didn't come out nearly as well as I would have liked, but you get the idea. How many of you have played SimCity? Yeah. SimCity is another example of one of these spreadsheet type games. You put in your tax rate, you allocate, you know, your residential areas, your commercial areas, and then the game engine runs. And it calculates things like commercial development, people moving in, people driving on the roads, that sort of thing. And the idea here, again, is that it's an immersive environment. Game category, I think it's kind of lame, but that's where you take an existing game that people are familiar with, like Jeopardy, and you use it in an educational context. As Clark Aldrich said, you know, nobody wants to take a test, but everybody wants to play Jeopardy, even if it's the same content. Which is kind of, there's got to be a whole psychology behind that. But it's another thing you need to have three beers before you get into. And then finally, the lab games. The lab games are the most pure simulations, if you will. My favorite was the helicopter that they have, Canadian Forces Base Gagetown. They let me fly in their helicopter simulator. And I had a wonderful, though short, flight. Actually, it's not clear that it was actually a flight because they let me take it off. And as far as I can tell, as soon as I hit the controls, the helicopter went plunk. So, actually, I did get the flight in the air. And then it was like all of several seconds before I crashed it. Lots of fun. Now, these are computer analogies, I can never figure out which word I want to use there, of the immersive environment that I'm talking about when I talk about things like the Living Arts Center. But it's not just games.
Stephen, before you move on from the games, what you've said, what you stated here, aren't those extremely, even in the corporate sector or educational sector, very time-consuming and expensive to create and stay ahead of your learners? Or, I mean, isn't that the challenge that's always been with any type of these type of game-based learning?
Well, okay, yeah. That's a good question. That's why I have to pause for a second. A game, I speak with having had experience in game design. I've actually done it. It's been a while now, but I have. Yeah, it eats time. And if you have to pay for that time, it becomes expensive. So game development is intensive. It's hard. And if you are in an environment where you are creating games to, as you say, stay a step ahead of the learner, then it's going to dramatically increase the cost of online learning. My response to that, and it anticipates a few slides ahead, but this is a good spot for it, is that you don't design the games. You have the students design the games. That's what we did. My introduction to the internet was in what was called a multi-user dungeon. Or a MUD. Any of you familiar with MUDs? What a MUD is, it's an online multi-user game. It's an environment. The original MUDs were from like Lord of the Rings themes. So you have, you know, orcs, and you have trolls, and you have dragons, and your characters take on the role of magician or warrior or thief. I was always a thief until I became a wizard. I didn't stop being a thief, though. I just got a lot better at it. And the MUDs were typically text-based. MUDs have a long history online. They began with a game called Adventure that was circulated around mainframes in the mid to late 70s. I first saw Adventure in 1980, and by then it was a well-established phenomenon. And the multi-user part came in later on when people used a program called Telnet, which is basically a console access to a computer. So basically all you're seeing is text. Even so, even without graphics and monsters that really breathe fire, they were still very time-consuming. But the way MUDs are set up, you join a MUD, you're a vanilla, you're a newbie, you get killed a lot. You don't have very much power, you don't have very much experience in that, but you explore, right? You kill mice to get food and things like that, and gradually you acquire more experience. Typically, you probably begin mapping out the MUD that you're in because it's all in different rooms and areas and things like that. You get to know other people because these MUDs are interactive zones. People talk to each other. And the MUD that I lived on, it was called Mud Dog MUD, based at the University of Florida. We had a thing called the Secret Spy Shades. And the Secret Spy Shades were basically a message everyone system. Now, of course, you'd take off the shades and turn off the chatter. But, we'd type SS and then whatever we wanted to say. And that message would go to everybody else who was wearing Secret Spy Shades. But, they weren't just there. You had to actually meet somebody, and somebody would show you where to get the shades. And it wasn't hard to do. People usually figured it out in the, the first few days of playing. But, it's still, you had to connect. And that's the thing with these MUDs, is to do almost anything, you had to connect with other people. Gradually, as you were more experienced playing MUDs, you would get together with groups of people and solve puzzles called quests. And as you solved quests and as you killed mice or other such things, you would increase in levels. In Mud Dog, and this is fairly typical, there are 20 levels. And you go, and there'd be different names, right? You'd be Labatt the Vanilla, was a newbie, and then you go Labatt the Chocolate, Labatt the Raspberry Truffle. Names for all the levels. And then at level 20, you've solved all the quests. You've killed enough things. You've made enough friends. So the MUDs were very violent. It's their heritage. Then you were promoted to wizard. And this is where the genius of MUDs comes out, because when you're promoted to a wizard, what do? You start building part of the game. And so a lot of people were just social mudders. They'd log on, they'd chat, they'd go around, kill some things just for fun or whatever, but they weren't really interested in advancement. Other people, like me, spent weeks, months, years working their way up through the system, becoming intimately familiar with the game in order to be a wizard, in order to start getting into the back end of the game and programming new areas of the game. I built all kinds of areas. I built a model of Plato's cave, and you go in, you see all the chained figures, and some of them are alive, so you kill them. I built a three-dimensional castle, which, as the description said, had numerous monks, which you killed. I set up a little quest with a door. Once you closed it, you couldn't reopen it. You'd have to get a friend outside. Things like that. So that's the answer to the question, is the students design the games. Game builders know this. And if you look at some of the more popular games, video games that have come out, Doom, for example, or Civilization is another example, what they have are what are called mods, short for modifications. And they design these games deliberately in such a way that users can modify them and create their own versions of the game. Civilization is a really good example, because Civilization is built on typically historical scenarios. The rise of Rome, the Napoleonic Wars, the conquest of Gaul, whatever. And so there's already a bit of an educational aspect to these. And what has been happening is that some people have been modifying civilization so that it becomes more overtly educational. Do I want to go any further with that? No, I think that was a pretty good role. Did that answer your question? I could have done the whole talk on that, so I thought I'd better stop at a certain point.
That's good.
But the important thing here, and I'm going to come back to this, but I do want to presage this a little bit, is the whole idea of the learners creating their own learning content. I think that this is going to be a very important development. Following the same theme is a different area which is raised by different people, and probably Jay Cross is the most prominent proponent of this, is a thing called workflow learning. And the idea here is that learning opportunities are integrated into the tools and appliances that people use for work. Now, the simplest, although the most dysfunctional example that you may all be familiar with is the help function in Microsoft. I'm sure you've all, at some point or another in Word or PowerPoint or something, clicked on that little help option. It didn't really help a whole lot. I mean, a few problems with Microsoft Help. The big problem is the only help you're going to get comes from Microsoft. And they're the ones who wrote the program. They already know how it works, and help reflects that. It's not written from the point of view of somebody who needs to learn about Word or PowerPoint. It's written from the point of view who just needs a tip or a reminder or something like that. I've always thought that help should actually connect to a much wider array of learning opportunities. Because when I hit help, one thing I know for sure is I need help. And I want to be able to choose my help. I mean, if I was Microsoft and I was designing help, I'd be getting vendors or learning design companies or whatever to create content that I would then make available through help. I would be collaborating with a company that has things like online mentors or online consultants or whatever. And for $2.95, if you hit help for $2.95, say, you could talk to a real person who's an expert at that particular thing. Why haven't they done this? It's really weird that they haven't done that. Workflow learning, properly so called, is the integration of this sort of functionality right into the workflow. At CSTD, I went to a talk by some people from the Imperial Bank of Commerce, and I don't completely support what they did, but you can sort of see how they've gone partway to this. The bank has call centers. What do they call them? BRCs, I think it was, Bank Representative Centers, they're call centers. They have all kinds of words used to disguise the fact that they're call centers, which is very interesting. They call their buildings as well pavilions, which was a bit of new to me. Anyhow, so you have these people who are basically, their job is to answer phone calls and handle inquiries and whatnot. And phone calls being phone calls, you have ebbs and flows of phone calls. So what the bank has done is, when there's an ebb in the phone calls, and you can detect this, right, then it pops into learning. So you're sitting there, you're one of these bank customer representatives, and you're sitting there, and the calls slow down, and boink, up pops a little bit of learning. And you do your 10, 15 minutes of learning, and you're done, and then you start answering phone calls again. Now, I personally, I find that a little bit intrusive, because when the calls slow down, I want to sit back a little bit and take a breather. You know, also, I want to be the one who's in charge of whether the thing goes boink and presents me with learning. The bank said, well, then they're a bank, right? So their approach was, we will tell you. That's how they deal with my checking account, too. But the idea here would be that the little thing would pop up when I asked it. Okay, it's been slow for a couple of minutes. I'm kind of twiddling my thumbs up. Let's see what's up next. Or even better, I'm on the phone with a client, and the client has a question, and is so commonly the case, I don't have a clue. But I can call up the learning right on the spot and find out what it is that the client needs to go while I'm on the phone with the client. Now that's integrating learning right with work. Now, I've thought about this because, I don't really think a lot about call centers and banks, but I do think a lot about things like, fishing, which is where I'd much rather be. And I went fishing when I was a kid. I was a spectacularly unsuccessful fisher. In fact, I caught one, which I lost. because you catch a fish, you put it on the little loop, and you put it back in the water, right? Fish was smarter than I was. And so my one fish that I caught, at least I was able to serve, as my parents came driving by the bridge, right? They wanted to, I don't know, but I'm sure they were. It was just a coincidence. But anyhow, and I showed them the fish, put it back in the water, and like half an hour later, it's gone. But at least I had a fish. Anyhow, so I'm not a very good fisher. So it seems to me, why can't my fishing rod teach me to fish? How hard would that be? Right? Because I've got a fishing rod, so I have a physical implement. Computer technology is small enough today that it can be put into a fishing rod. At the very least, you can do is put RFID, so enough to send a signal to my PDA, which would, of course, always be on my belt, because it's also my phone, and it's also my television, and it's also my camera. And so the fishing rod sends the signal to the PDA, so now the fishing rod and the PDA are talking to each other. And so I take a cast, and the internal sensors in the fishing rod detect the motion in the arc of my cast, and the fishing rod says to me, you've never fished before, have you? And I deny it, of course. But what the fishing rod does is it makes sets of lessons on how to fish at the appropriate level available to me. Now, this would be free, of course, because they're provided by the manufacturers of the fishing rod as part of the fishing rod. Just like you buy Kraft Dinner, there's a little recipe on the back. Right? They don't charge you extra for that recipe, right? Be nuts if they did. Who'd buy it? It's a recipe for Kraft Dinner. Well, the same thing with the fishing rod. They don't charge you extra for the lessons on how to fish. Now, if you want to talk to a famous or well-experienced online mentor, that might cost you something because, they're expensive. But the basic how to fish lessons, those are free. So you tell your fishing rod, okay, show me how to cast. And the fishing rod explains, right, the PDA is accessing the content off the internet. It's coming in because I'm fishing. Probably the best mode is audio because I'm not going to be looking at a video screen or reading text. Or I'm certainly not going to take a 40-hour course because I'm on the river, right? And the fishing rod or the PDA, one or the other, will now start to explain to me how to fish. And I'll hold the rod back like that, and the sensors are going back and forth. The idea here is that the learning is embedded in the activity. And the learning content or the learning resources are embedded in the physical environment. And that's why when I go to a place like the Living Arts Center, I see not just a big play area or a place where you send your kids on a Saturday afternoon so that they're doing ballet and you can go fishing, but I see this as the sort of place where this kind of learning can happen, where the learning can be built into the activity. And my inclination is to say, as much as possible, we want to make that the case, the everyday case, rather than the exception. Because when you think about it, it is very odd to take children, of all things, and put them in a room, possibly like this, with no windows, poor air circulation, make them turn off all of their communication devices, and then speak to them. Like, kind of like we're doing here. Except I didn't tell you to turn off your cell phones, because my thinking is, if I can't compete with your cell phone should win. So, that's the picture. That's the model. So here we are at a crossroads. Right? All of you, I think, if not all of you, the vast majority of you, are engaged in traditional, as I call it, traditional means like, you know, 5 years old, traditional online, well, I guess it's almost 10 years now, as time flies, online learning, where you are working at developing online courses or online classes. You are almost certainly working within the context of a learning management system. Your course, your learning, is housed at an institution such as this university. This institution, meanwhile, wants to be, certainly attempts to be, and structures itself to be the sole learning provider for that given individual. That's one picture of online learning. The other picture is the picture that I've been sketching in rough strokes. Immersive learning, game-based learning, informal learning, workflow learning. These are all different names for the same concept, where instead of the institution being at the center, the student is at the center. Instead of the institution being the sole provider, it is one of many providers. Instead of the institution being like one of those Greek archons saying, you will learn such and such, the decisions are made by the learner, at the learner's own time, and where the learner wants to be. So there is clearly a crossroads here. And you know, part of this talk is supposed to be projections of the future of learning. My projection of the future of learning is that this traditional way is on the decline. I think there's plenty of evidence for that. We will ignore the evidence that says pretty well every college, school, and university in the world has bought one of these things. So we'll just write that off as a bad experience. But if you look at the discussion and the chatter around learning management systems, you see a lot of frustration. Right now, let's be honest. Like, learning management systems and online learning, way better than what was available before, which was either sitting in a class or, even worse, nothing. You know, the comparison between learning management system and nothing, learning management system wins, hands down. There's no question about that. So you will see a lot of surveys that say the learning management system was much better than what I had, because before I couldn't go to school at all because I had to work. Now I can take classes online. And in some cases, even, it's a bit cheaper. Not very often, but that's a different issue, which I won't get into. But learning management system and classes and institution-based learning, as compared to a robust system of informal learning, and again, there's no comparison. And what is the evidence for this? Well, what is more popular with users, WebCT or Google? Where do more people go when they have free time? A Blackboard site or Yahoo Games? So if you look at the evidence, if you look at the traffic out on the internet, people are flowing toward these informal sites rather than these formal sites. Wikipedia, people out there on the internet for no pay have built an entire encyclopedia. I can't think of one case of formal structured learning that compares with that sort of effort. So I think we can see this flow. And I think that as time goes by, as the mechanisms for the immersive and informal learning come into the forefront, that we're going to see increased pressure on formal learning and especially learning management systems. And I say that knowing at this point a lot of these mechanisms are not in place yet. The fishing rod that teaches you doesn't exist. Another thing that may be closer, my other favorite example is strawberry jam that teaches you how to use strawberry jam. That is closer. Walmart started and then sort of hesitated on a program that would require providers to put RFID chips on their products. Now, the providers just couldn't tool up in time. It's just, the logistics were just nightmarish. I mean, they wanted to, they just couldn't do it. But it's going to happen. Because there's no reason not to put an RFID chip on a jar of strawberry jam.
What's an RFID chip?
Oh, I'm sorry. Remote frequency identification. What that is, it's a little computer chip, very small, that you can embed on a product, or some people say a person. I don't really agree with that one. There is a school, where was it, Florida, that made all of its students wear little badges with RFIDs, and then, well, there was an uprising, as there should be. And what the RFID is, it's a very low-intensity wireless signal, so that as you walk by a sensor, say, the sensor can pick up that signal, and you send just a little bit of information back and forth. And it's like an ID badge, but it's just sending a wireless signal. So, and that's how your strawberry jam can talk to your PDA, right? Your PDA picks up the RFID from the strawberry jam that you're holding in your hand, and then your PDA tells your kitchen wall screen to display strawberry jam recipes. So this is going to happen. And it's inconceivable that it would not happen. Flat screen displays right now are ridiculously expensive, but the prices are coming down dramatically. I've been reading about nanotube flat screen displays, which for one about yay big is in like the $400 or $500 range. They're not in production yet. They will be. When these things are $400 or $500, you'll probably have one in every room. Why not? Because, go ahead.
I don't know if this is part of your discussion, but the very topic of the fishing rod that teaches you how to fish. I'm wondering if you want to discuss that a little bit more, because I can imagine you get into a situation where you get a fishing rod that does the fishing for you, and you don't really have to learn how to fish. Because I'm sort of reminded of the standing in line at Wendy's watching the alarm go off, and they walk over to the alarm and it says stir chili, and they stir chili, and they don't look at their watch, and they don't know what they have to do because they're being instructed with every step of the way, and I'm wondering if this develops to the point where you can just be in a position to take instruction as opposed to learning.
The wonder about Wendy's is that they actually have a human stir the chili, because it doesn't really seem to be a need. the fishing rod could do the fishing for you. And if it were just the case of fish production, we'd probably want the fishing rod to do the fishing. We'd probably prevent overfishing. You could tell the fishing rod to stop fishing. Fishing isn't about getting a fish out of the water, right? There's that myth. You went fishing, you didn't catch any fish. A group of friends and I, when I was living in Calgary, we went up to Kananaskis on the May-long weekend, in fact. So it would be like, I don't know, 25 years ago to this day or something like that. I don't think it was quite that long ago, but was close. And we went to Kananaskis to go fishing, and we went up to Kananaskis Lakes. And, you know, this is before the park opened, and so you're kind of roughing it out there, it snowed. And according to local lore, we were using corn as bait, because that's supposed to be what worked, because Kananaskis Lakes, they're artificial lakes, they get stocked with fish. So the fish go after what they were raised on, and that was, well, corn. Corn-fed fish. So we're out there, and we got our gear and all of that, and the ranger comes by and says, you know, they haven't stocked the lake yet, right? Because it's too early in the season. There's no fish in the lake. We said, that's fun. And we cast our line and kept fishing, because it didn't matter whether we caught any fish. The whole concept is to go to the mountains with your friends, with your fishing rods, get snowed on, and have a good time. And the concept here is that the technology makes it easier. This, you're right, this is a little off topic, but it strikes me as amazing and a little bit appalling that after 100 years of increased automation, computerized factories, robots that build cars, computers that could stir chili if we asked them to, that we're still working the same amount of time a week that we did near the beginning of the century. As you sort of scratch your head at this and wonder, how could this have come to be? Part of what I'm promoting, it's not the right word, what I'm trying to describe when I talk about all of this is the idea of work as drudgery, like stirring chili and things like that, ought to be and will be a thing of the past, where work becomes what it is that we want to do, where what it is that we want to do becomes part of learning, where all of these things merge into the same thing. Our current lives are lives where there's a box for working, there's a box for learning, there's a small box for your vacation, and they're all separate, right? And how did that song go? You know, I work all year so I can go to Echo Beach. That model, I think, fades. And it fades as we become more empowered, more able to learn by doing, less reliant on structured mechanisms of production and of commerce. I know that's wild, hand-wavy stuff. And again, I could spend the rest of the day talking about that. But I do believe that that's the direction in which we're headed. Does that sort of address the question?
I think so.
It's kind of like solving the river problem by producing a swamp, I know.
It just seems to me that if there's such a readily available system to your task,
yeah,
it sort of negates the need to learn. Now, chili's
well, sure. I don't need to learn how to run 40 miles an hour, right? Because I got a car. But, you know, I mean, is there any value in learning this? Sometimes there is, but whose choice is it? It's yours.
I'm wondering if perhaps the difference in the chili example is different learning stuff. One is being constantly shown the correct way, and perhaps without that, the way of learning is by burning the chili and making a mistake. Next time you can realize, oh, you know, 4 minutes.
I think maybe the fishing rod is a better example for what I'm trying to get at. Is I can fish correctly, but it's because I'm being told repeatedly that this is how you do it. And I don't have to commit anything to memory, and I don't have to sort of absorb that information because the information is now readily available.
But do you
it's
see?
Like memorizing phone numbers in the phone book. I don't have to because I know quickly how to get
it. So the neat thing, though, is you will absorb that information. Your fishing rod tells you how to cast 5, 10, 20 times. You don't need to go through any sort of learning process. It will happen. So, and then you will learn. Oh, that got the hands.
How ironic that on the May long weekend, fishing becomes a really contentious topic.
Yeah, what a surprise.
Like your comment about fishing when the lake wasn't stocked, and that was still satisfying. To me, it's reconciling that I'm going fishing for the experience of fishing, the getaway, and leave the office, leave the PBA, that escapism that you talked about, that fishing was perfectly satisfactory, just the experience of casting the rod. So,
you're thinking of leaving the PBA at home as being like leaving the office at home. Right.
Well, I guess it's reconciling that your earlier comment about fishing being totally satisfactory when you knew you weren't going to catch any fish. So how do you get from that to you have to be improving at fishing?
But you don't have to be. This is the whole point.
So is that the choice then that you can buy the fishing rod that's programmed or you can buy the manual or switch it on or off?
You're next. Consider the ecology of fish, right? You could fish with no knowledge and no reasonable expectation of success. You can fish in a learning environment and get better. You can become a commercial fisher, an expert in fishing, and use much more involved things like boats. You can buy fish at a grocery store and cook it yourself. You can go to a restaurant and order fish. And to take that one step further, you can use fish emulsion on your plants, grow tomatoes, and trade the tomatoes for fish. Now, which one of those is the right answer? Well, obviously none of them, right? Who makes the call? The person deciding how to interact with fish. And so, when we come back to your comment was, well, mode one is unsatisfactory because mode two exists, right? But sometimes you don't care to learn to fish and you just leave the thing turned off. Other times you want to learn to fish. Other times you just want to go to a grocery store, and having a fishing rod at all would be an absurd proposition. It's the range.
And that's what I was going to say. If I went out fishing with Jane, for instance, I mean, Jane's quite the fisher, so Jane would probably do the rod and have that and find out how far it went and how to do it better, etc. I would go with her just for the social contact, but I would just fish and I really wouldn't care what the rod said.
Right.
So I think the bottom line is that it has to be, again, learner-centered. Is it part of my interest to use that in a particular way? So you would then have the choices of the just-in-time learning. What is it that you want to learn?
And part of the thesis, and this is, it's a part that is a bit less believable, but that's okay, is that as these tools make you personally more empowered, the requirement to stop doing the thing that you're doing for fun and go stir chili for a living for 8 hours, that becomes less and less necessary. That as your tools make you more capable, the thing that you want to do can also be the thing that you do for a living. And then this whole idea of like going to the office, stopping your fun because you need to work, things like that, that fades into the background. Now, will that be 100% the case? Obviously not. There are still jobs that people probably won't do for a hobby. I can list a few of them. Although a surprising number of them people will do because they're interested in it and enjoy it. I mean, again, I was at that Living Arts Center, and that's just one of many institutions of that sort of thing. There's somebody manufacturing glass bottles there. The manufacturer, who would have thought manufacturing is something that people do because they like it? But there's the Sunday on a long weekend, and a nice day, too. Tell from the sun I got. Where is he? He's buying bottles with a couple other people, but basically in this room, in front of a big blast oven making glass bottles. Who would conceive of this? I'm sure he wasn't being paid. And if he got good enough at that, he can support himself doing it. And if not, that's fine too. Anyhow, that's sort of off topic a little bit, but that's okay.
I
swore to myself I wouldn't actually stay in this particular topic. This fishing rod thing started bothering me.
Oh, that's fine. I mean,
the idea that you've got a program that tells you how to cast and how to catch a fish, this kind of thing, doesn't it actually promote a very formalized type of learning? For example, a baseball player, somebody, you know, you could take a baseball player, have his bat, explain the same thing, how he hits the ball.
Right.
But there are many different ways to hit that ball. And some of the best baseball players have been folk who've had unorthodox approaches. If you've got a program that tells you how to do things properly,
yeah,
isn't that actually an over-formalization of education? Things aren't that black and white.
Well, now you've tapped into a beautiful issue. It's kind of the same issue I was trying to get at with Microsoft Help, right? Because there are various ways of dealing with Microsoft products. There's the way Microsoft says you should do, how you should do it, and then there's the way that actually works, which sometimes involves trading in... No, never mind. I'm going to show some charts and diagrams and a little technical stuff a little bit later, but when we have this choice and we've chosen to take the red pill and plunge into the future, now the question becomes, how do you set up the network of learning resources and opportunities in just such a way as to avoid the problem you've just highlighted? Because you don't want to buy a fishing rod that teaches you the one and only way to fish. Because really, you haven't really advanced very far. For one thing, there's no community there. You know, I mean, it's just you, your fishing rod, and the advertising agency. And it's probably just going to try to sell you more gear. You know, if you had better floats, then you wouldn't need to learn this. You know, you have to have, at this end point, at this consumer point, I really hate that word, but we'll use it, at the learner point, there has to be not single-streamed resources, but a diverse set of opportunities. And the question becomes, how do you build the network in such a way as to make that possible? What are the principles that underlie that? And it's an important question because traditional institutions, and by that I mean universities and colleges, as well as companies like Microsoft or Disney, and for that matter, governments and government agencies, will, given the opportunity, stream you toward a single solution. All kinds of reasons for that. It's cheaper for them, right? If car manufacturers could have gotten away with selling only black cars, they would have. If they could have gotten away with selling you only one brand of car, they would have. Happily, they couldn't. But it's easier to sell only one brand of a thing. There's a story, I don't know, I don't have a reference off the top of my head, but you can find it through Google. Bookstores. Now, purchasing books, deciding what books to purchase in a bookstore is time-consuming and expensive. And so what some bookstores have been doing is outsourcing this function to the book publisher. So, now, you can just see where this is going, right? You have, the example in the story that I read is there was a shelf of books with Japanese cooking. You know, there's sushi, sukiyaki, and other Japanese-type foods, right? There's a whole range of books. When the publishers took over, they took that range of books and said, well, okay, all you really need is one book that covers Japanese fishing. Or fishing. Japanese cooking. And so they replaced all the other books with that one book. And if you go to your local bookstore, this is a recent phenomenon in the last few years. If you go to your bookstore and you notice that the choices have dwindled in your area of interest, this is the thing that's happening, right? Where they can, if they have the opportunity, they will narrow the selection. And then, of course, the natural, inevitable direction that any commercial enterprise goes, because that's how they're designed, is toward monopoly. And so if they can, they will attempt to monopolize a domain. And I'm not saying that as a moral judgment or anything like that. I'm saying it as an empirical observation of the structure of corporations in the marketplace. This is what corporations try to do. And so consequently, again, if they could, they would try to monopolize that fishing rod. So it's imperative from, how do I want to say it, an economic, sociological, even a personal freedom perspective, that at that point of contact, at that point of contact, you, your fishing rod, that connects not to a supplier, but to a network. And if there is a network at that point rather than a provider, then you get a wide range. And then it's not just the manufacturer's suggested retail learning opportunities, but now you're tapping into or able to tap into, the community of fishers, if you will. The why, and not just learning opportunities, but if you wanted to chat instead of learn, your fishing rod could put you in touch with somebody else who's fishing, or somebody else who wishes they were fishing and would like to share the experience with you, or in touch with a professional who will give you tips on it, anything you can think of at that point. And that's how you get away from that formalism. Instead of connecting to a point, you connect to a network. Does that make sense? Just as a check, how many of you are buying into this picture? Okay, bad way of phrasing it. Some, maybe not all. That's cool. You don't all have to agree. There have to be some people doing this stuff too. I mean, and let me be clear, it's not like the other thing's going to go away entirely. It's going to morph. I think there's no question about that. It will change. And I was talking with Mike yesterday about what happens to colleges and universities when informal learning networks become primary. What happens to the structure of colleges and universities? And to put it flippantly, but not inaccurately, they become country clubs. And that is already the direction in which they are moving. If you look at economics publications or university business or things like that, you see the trend that more and more colleges and especially universities are investing in infrastructure designed not to improve the pedagogy, but to improve the social atmosphere of the university. So they invest in things like residences. They invest in things like music download services in residences. They invest in things like student centers, things like that. There's a lot of investment happening, especially in the U.S., in that direction. And the idea is to, because universities are less and less able to differentiate themselves as centers of learning. Pretty hard for, if you're going to compete on pure knowledge, university versus Google, it's not as one-sided a battle as you might think. Universities have to differentiate themselves in other ways. And a natural and obvious way of doing it is to focus on the social, focus on the community, focus on the experience. And I don't think that'll go away. I do think you'll have to be pretty rich to go to them. And I do think that will be education for people who have the money to spend on 4 years and what amounts to a social club. But I don't think it'll disappear. Or if it does disappear, it'll be the same time that, I don't know, penthouse apartments disappear, etc. Okay, well, I was a little off the top.
I think that what you're talking about, I just want to say, and I'm not saying this in a critical sense, a lot of what you're discussing today goes to me, and simply because I have a few more years of experience here, goes back to the 1960s. In North America, at least in the educational system, we had what was called a
automatic revolution.
Sure.
And the whole approach gradually shifted from education from above to education of equals. We had Illich's book, The Equal in Society. We had a number of other books that came out at that time. And the whole concept of learning links was put together.
Right.
Now, what I see with technology now is that we have this technological umbrella or web that can be put into place to bring forth some of those, some of that movement that in the 60s was conceptual but not necessarily realizable because all we had was media, print, telephones. Now with the online network, this technological web, we can achieve some of those goals.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I refer to Illich from time to time in my newsletter in this context. And it's that kind of picture that I'm after and that I'm trying to describe here. So, yeah, absolutely. So how do we do it? How do you pull it off? Okay, first iteration. There's your games question. Because this stuff's expensive to do. So the first iteration is user-produced media. I'm producing a learning resource right now. And not one of those, you know, temporary virtual resources that disappears when I leave the room. I'm recording this talk, assuming that the battery is holding out and that the program hasn't crashed. Happens sometimes. I'm just, well, let's check that while we're here. You like to check these things. And away we are. We're still recording. Life is good. Let's find out where we are again. And back up to the big slide. I feel better. I'm producing learning resources right now. And I'm doing it very easily. Audacity is free software, open source, free and open source software. I'm going to convert it into MP3 format. Audacity will do that for me. I just hit File, Export, MP3. And then I'll take that file and I'll use another free program, FTP program called FileZilla. And I'll use that to upload the MP3 file that I created onto my website. And then I'll create an RSS file and declare the location of that MP3 file inside an enclosure tag, and I have just made this talk available to the entire world, and available in such a way that they don't need to go looking for it, it will just pop up on their screen. But not on everyone's screen, because that would be really annoying. It will pop up only on the screens of those people who have asked to subscribe to information of exactly this sort. So the idea here is that user-produced media dramatically increases the supply of media that we have. It increases the flexibility and it creates this pool of resources. If we had to hire Disney to produce, 40 or 50 talks on educational technology, they'd come back to us with a bill for several million dollars. Or at the CSTD conference, for example, where I was just last week, I didn't get to talk about it at that conference, so I'll talk about it here. There I was, sitting there with my little microphone, and I had my video camera in a sock, so I wouldn't break it. So there I was, and I'm recording, and they were doing it the proper way. So they had two cameramen, and they had one of these big mixer boards, and they had a person in the back room organizing it all the feeds and the lights and all the big production. And at the end of the talk, my talk was online, already being listened to. Well, actually, it took me about 5 minutes to upload it. But they were still, well, I'm still waiting for theirs to come out. And I hear there was a problem. So, but normally there isn't a problem. But the contrast that I want to draw out between how easy it was for me to do it as compared to how expensive it can get. Now, the quality of this, okay, I admit it, iffy. But the main point is that it's tolerable, that it's good enough for people to listen to and get the content. And if it's not good enough, email me. I always like to put little private messages to the listeners. What I've just described, and what I'm doing right now, in fact, is podcasting. What I have been doing for a number of years is blogging. Blogging couldn't be simpler. If you wanted to start a blog right now, you would go to blogger.com. You'd click on the big button that says start a blog. You'd type in a title. You'd pick a template just by hitting the little radio button. You'd press enter. Then you'd click on create a post. You type something, you hit enter, you're done. And if you want to create more posts, you don't even need to do that complex a process. You go back to Blogger, you go into your blog, and the link's right there, it's your blog. Click create a post, and you type your post. The window that you're typing it into is what they call a WYSIWYG window, which is, I always thought was a stupid name, which means that you don't need to learn HTML or anything like that. You want it bold, you click the bold button. You want a link, you click the link button. It does all of that for you, so you don't need any advanced skills. I'm surprised you still have to type this stuff, and I find that really annoying. You know, and actually, if you find the Blogger interface too confusing for you, just write an email to your blog. And it'll go, it'll be part of your, be the next post in your blog, your email entry. You can send in entries with PDAs. They have audio blogs, which are a lot like podcasting, except what you do is you phone your blog. And you just dial the number, say what you have to say, hang up, you're done. Your audio blog is there. The point here is that it is becoming ridiculously easy to produce content of all sorts, including learning content. And so I'm producing learning content now. And as the slide suggests, over time, and by over time I mean in the next few years, it will become very simple to produce increasingly complicated multimedia applications. I saw just last week an open source application, free of course, that lets you build Flash animations. So you don't have to go out and buy Flash anymore. Woohoo! Yeah. all of these modding kits for the games. You can take Civilization and change it so that it's barely recognizable as Civilization anymore, but instead of it is this really interesting interactive game that you're playing. You can just, you know, take Doom. I guess people don't play Doom anymore, but they used to. That was once a big game. Mod Doom. Mod it out so that you're not in a castle or whatever anymore. You're, I don't know, wherever you want to be. So, that's first iteration. We see this. We see this happening now. We are seeing our students before our eyes become content producers with more capacity to produce their own content than we've ever had, than any generation in history has ever had. It's got to change the dynamics. Second iteration, this year's fad, and I call it a fad just because of the title. The concept is sound. The concept's been around for a while. The name is the fad part. E-portfolios. Right? There were e-portfolios before they were called e-portfolios. But, you know, some government offices have tweaked on that. And you know, there will be, you know, the shrink wrap e-portfolio products will hit the shelves anytime now, I'm sure. But it doesn't really matter. But the concept is, the concept of an e-portfolio is very similar, indeed almost identical, to the concept of a personal website. It's a place that belongs to you and not to your university or not to your employer, where you put up the stuff you have done. That's it in a nutshell. This is why I say the name is a bit of a fad. And so I've borrowed this phrasing from Scott Wilson. Scott, yesterday, in fact, came out with a really, really nice slide presentation. I linked to it in my newsletter, decided to steal some of it today. See what I mean about producing the content and the interaction and that? Like, I'm borrowing stuff from Scott that he produced yesterday. Scott's in Britain. 10 years ago, this would have been hard. 20 years ago, this would have been impossible. Unless you were very, very rich. 100 years ago, forget it. You have to wait till the steamship comes in. So, from putting on the educator glasses, it's a learner-managed construct, provides easy-to-use tools and hosting services, e-portfolio as blog approach.
Is this something like DeviantArt.com? Have you seen that site?
I don't know. Yeah, I haven't seen it.
It's
DeviantArt. Yes, yeah. I have an account on that. And 4 or 5 bad pictures.
is that what you're talking about?
It's if you took DeviantArt, made it a lot faster, had more than one. The problem with DeviantArt is like the whole world uses the one website, so like it moves at like 2 miles an hour. And if you had it to be something other than just uploaded photographs and uploaded anything, then something like that. Flickr's a good example of that sort of thing. 43 things in a small, very narrow sort of way. There are various sites that are trying to be this sort of locus. What's the name of that image service that Google acquired?
Picasa,
that's it. Google is moving in that direction. Yahoo, particularly with the introduction of Yahoo 360, which is their version of a blogging engine, they are moving in that direction as well. And basically, give it a few years, and what will happen is you'll go online, you'll be able to pick from one of these providers, Flickr, Yahoo, Google, Microsoft, but it'll be slow, won't run Firefox.
Yeah.
Talk about like just ruling yourself out of the game, right? These sites have to be wildly flexible, right? They have to support all operating systems, all browsers. They have to support not just browsers, but PDAs, cell phones, fishing rods, eventually. But you'll pick your spot, right? Or you might just do what I did. I just got an account with an ISP and then set up, in my case I wrote the software, but you can just set up some free software. You log onto an ISP account, a service provider account now, and they give you a little control panel. And you want a wiki? Click a button. Shoo! You get a wiki. You want a content management system to produce your own online newspaper or something like that? It's a one-button operation. You hit the button and post new, because on your site, customized to taste. And as disk space becomes cheaper, as storage becomes cheaper, you're now able to upload more and more media to these sites. Gmail, Google Mail, what is it, a gigabyte limit? 2 gigabytes now. Quite a bit of space. Now, not so good if you're storing photographs. You'll run out of that in a couple of years. But for email, basically unlimited. But that's, 2005 is 2 gigabytes. What's it going to be in 2015?
When you talk about e-portfolio, Stephen, what about accuracy of assessment? Who is assessing that, I'm a doctor. Say I'm a doctor on a blog or the education institution, you're not a qualified doctor. I create this portfolio, and it's the same. I don't know. One of the things with wikis is, anyone can edit, saying that Napoleon did this or Napoleon didn't do this.
Sure.
Well, where does the Wild West eventually meet the reality?
It's interesting phrasing. Credentials are about as artificial a system as you could possibly come up with, but we'll leave that aside. Scott Wilson's presentation, which I just mentioned, the latter third of his presentation is devoted to this, and his answer is authentication. You go through an authentication process. I don't really believe in authentication, and I don't believe in authentication because it's not necessary in the real world. I don't think it suddenly becomes necessary online. When you go to a 7-Eleven, you don't give them a thumbprint in order to be able to buy a chocolate bar online. You would. It's stupid. So, let's analyze this credentialing thing. Okay. I have a website, say. It's one of these e-portfolio sites, say. Maybe I built it. Maybe I got it from an ISP. Maybe an institution like a university is providing it for me, although I'd be pretty silly if I did that because I'm going to lose it at the end of 4 years, right? Who wants to lose their website? Universities have to be thinking about lifetime hosting if they want people to use their websites. There's a thought. I actually recommended that years ago, and nobody believed me, and they still don't believe me. But think about it. Imagine, like, because I'm going to come back to that. Online communities, right? Imagine you moved to a new town, and you made a whole bunch of friends and connections. You did a lot of things. You helped decorate the main street. And then after a few years, poof, it vanished. Imagine you did that and it vanished after 4 months. You know, we hear a lot of talk about communities being set up by academic institutions like universities, and then they kick everybody out. What kind of community is that? Yeah. Would you live here in Guelph or in Kitchener or whatever if after 4 years the government could come along and say, okay, you're done, move along, now we want the next group of people to come live here? That'd be an interesting concept for a town, but it's a lousy concept for a community. Anyhow, so you have your website. The presumption here is that you, more or less exclusively, control the contents of your website. In other words, if something appears on your website, things like hacking discounted, we'll assume that we solve hacking, right? Or assume that hacking is like crime. It's there, it's annoying, but it's manageable. But all other things being equal, if there is a notation on your website, it's there because you authorized it to be there. Right? So, now we've got... And we know how to do this. How do I get into my website to put content on? Well, I type, you know, username, password. And there's more or less security I can put. But generally, I mean, my website's pretty free and open, and I've only had hacking problems a couple of times. And that's because, you know, the first time I had hacking problems because I disabled the user login because I got tired of it. And that actually lasted a few months before somebody realized you don't have to log in to my website to change the content. The second time I did something stupid as well. I forget what it was, but... So, you log into your website, you make your change. It's not just that you know that that content is there because you authorized it. The world knows. Right? So, if you can associate me with my website, half the battle is done. Right? Now you've got content on the internet that you can pretty unambiguously attach to a person. At the very least, the person who owns that website. So, talking about credentialing, you put on your website, I have a BA. Now, your question is, just because you put it on the website doesn't mean it's true. Of course not. It's just like if you put it on a CV and send it to an employer, all right, again, this, you've got pretty much the same level of confidence in the CV as you do on the website, right? If it's on the CV that I sent to you, it's probably because I wanted it to be there, right? You know, people in the post office know that, ooh, CV, let's have some fun.
Yeah.
You know, although, that is the thought. Just to go in there and white out their credentials and just, you know, 2-year prison term. It doesn't happen, right? And an employer reads your CV, which is sitting there on a piece of paper, which can be reasonably reliably traced back to you, and it says BA. Well, how do they know? Well, they don't contact you for verification. That would be silly. They contact the university. So now, see, we got this triangle set up, right? And now we're going to get various iterations of that. But you can be reasonably sure of information that originates from the University of Calgary because it's on the U of C website. They presumptively have control over their own website, right? So if that website at some point in time says Stephen Downs does indeed have a BA from us, you can trust that. So the only question becomes, how do you get that to happen? Right? Now, if privacy wasn't a concern, there's no problem. The U of A just simply lists somewhere on their website, preferably as an XML file so it can be machine read, every person who's ever received a degree. That's easy. How hard is that? Presumably that information exists somewhere in the university record. How hard would it be to list every single person who got a degree? It wouldn't be that hard. So, and that, in fact, is the level of reliability you get today. Right? If you seek to obtain a transcript, the U of C sends it to you. Now, you make the inference that the person who gave you the CV is the person about whom the transcript has been sent. Now, is there room for fraud? Yes. It's not 100% perfect. Is it likely to suffer massive fraud? No. The cost is too high. It takes too much work to fake the credentials, and then when you're caught, you go to jail. There isn't really an upside to it. So you don't need lockdown security. You just need communications channels, reasonably reliable communication channels, where you can know that I've said something and you can know that they've said something. And then at a certain point, you take us at our word. You are, after all, hiring me, right? If you're going to start with a complete mistrust of anything that is said, that's probably not a good basis to begin an employment relation. So it'll be something like that. Now, Scott, if you look at his slide presentation, he will go into some detail about authentication. My position is that no system of authentication is any more secure than a system of self-identification. And the reasoning for that is as follows. All systems of authentication require, by definition, the compliance of the person being authenticated. But that compliance is no more or no less reliable than self-authentication. So authentication adds nothing over and above a reliable declaration that I am such and such. And if you can accept my declaration that I am so and so, then everything else is bells and whistles. That's my position on that.
Before you wanted to mention
that
some people may have appointments around 11 or so.
It's supposed to end at 11. Oh, darn, I was thinking 11:30.
But we continue on. I think they did get a people need to leave.
Well, I really think I should do this sort of like in the time frame that I promised to do it. I really hate it when people go overtime like that, and here I've done it. Let me give you the punchline anyway.
No, I don't want to.
Why don't you just continue?
Yes, by all means.
We're fine.
Are you guys all fine with it?
Yeah, we're
fine. Fair enough. I'll continue till I'm done. People have killed for that kind of opportunity. All right. There isn't a third iteration, but here's how it comes out. In what I have taken to calling the learning network. Oh, that's the same slide, isn't it?
The title changed from the slide.
Well, I wonder what I was going to put there. Well, I know what's supposed to go there. That's what you get for doing these things too early in the morning without even had a single beer. That was a bit of a joke. what you've got now is this huge mass of user-produced content, all forms. Already we're up to, I don't know, 100 billion blog posts or whatever, and most of them are pretty useless, but in and among those useless blog posts are a bunch of them, including even some of mine that are pretty useful. You also have a photo library larger than anything that could be imagined. The largest library right now in the world is probably something like Corbis with several million images. Think billions of images. I mean, Roland Tanglau has like tens of thousands of images on Flickr. He's one person. I've got hundreds of images of my own. I'm one person. Given time, we will have a shareable library of billions of images. Now, the question is, how do you find the good one out of all those really bad ones? Same problem. Additional content, audio content. There's audio content being produced like crazy. I've got, I don't know how many, 30 or 40 podcasts on my website now. And again, people are producing these things like crazy. These things are all out there. Now, I think of these things, in my own mind, as learning resources. And some of them are explicitly learning resources. I use the term learning resources instead of the term learning objects. And the reason why I do that is that the term learning objects has come to represent a very specific sort of digital entity. But I am more interested in digital entities more generically. Or to put the same story the other way around, most people define learning objects according to their internal construction. Do they have learning objectives? Do they have a little self-assessment? Things like that. I approach this differently, though. I say that an entity becomes a learning object or a learning resource when, and only when, it is used to support learning. So in other words, things become learning resources by use. And my definition of learning resources is a definition based in use. So, think this through. We got all of these resources. These resources can and will, some of them, be used by different people at different times. The simplest instance of a use is a view. Right? So we track views. A slightly more complicated instance of a use is a link. Somebody links to this resource. And you can build the hierarchy up and up from that. If you track or in some way record information about resources and how they are used, now you are building what may be called a metadata layer. Now, a lot of people have talked about metadata with reference to learning objects. And in fact, there's a whole IMS SCORM project for that, right? You know, and there's 87 fields, and the name, and the creator, and the semantic density, which to me is a bit of a fiction, but we'll leave that aside. Now, all of this stuff. And the big problem with learning objects properly so-called is that for each and every learning object, somebody's got to sit down and fill all those fields. And the short answer to that is not going to happen. The longer answer is, could happen, but you'd have to have the resources of a Microsoft or a Disney to do it. The cynical response is, and that's why it was set up that way. But if you can capture metadata through use, now you've eliminated the need to create specific metadata about these resources. The resource will kind of acquire the metadata. I wrote a paper called Resource Profiles, where I map this out. And a resource profile is a lot like a personal profile. And so this will tie into the portfolio thing nicely. Hasn't yet, but it will. If you think about it, when you're born, in addition to being very small, there is also not very much information about you, is there? Right? weight, which will probably increase thereafter. You have a birthday, by definition. You may have a name. You certainly have a last name. You have at least one parent. And, well, that's about it. Well, you have a blood type. There's a couple of other physical properties, but really, it's not very much, right? No criminal record yet. As time goes by, you interact with other people, and information begins to accumulate about you. Some of it you do for yourself, right? I know my ABCs, right? So you've created metadata for yourself. But a lot of this information is created by you interacting with other parts of society, right? You get, I went to Champlain Elementary School. How did that happen? I interacted with that school. Now we have a record, both in my memory and in that school, of me having gone there. That's metadata produced through use. And so what happens is the information about a person accumulates over the years. They get a driver's license. They get an A in grade 10 math. They get a high school diploma. They get their first speeding ticket. You can fill in all the rest of those details, right? Now, what's important here is two things. First of all, there's no such thing as like trying to fill out all of this metadata ahead of time, and indeed, this would be absurd, wouldn't it? And in fact, it would be a complete work of fiction. You know, when people say semantic density or things like that, I say flippantly and offhandedly, oh, that's a work of fiction. I mean that quite literally. If you've just produced a learning resource and you want to talk about, you know, its typical age range or semantic density or any of its other educational properties, you're making stuff up. Because you have no good grounds for knowing that this resource belongs in this grade. How do you find out? You find out by the fact that this resource is used in those grades. That's the only way to know. You can make a guess, but it's a guess. Until it's actually used, it's nothing more than a guess. And so it would have been pretty silly for my parents to have awarded me a master's degree the day I was born, because we're just sure, and they never would have picked philosophy anyways. So the other thing about this is the metadata doesn't all live in one place, right? Again, information about me, I put it on my CV, that's one story, right? But if you go and talk to, say, the criminal, but if you go talk to the U of C, they have another story. And if you go talk to the U of A, they have another story. Right? So there are different institutions that have different stories. So the resource, although it sits in one place on the internet, the information about that resource is distributed across the internet. This is what I mean when I talk about a learning network. Now, these resources themselves, think now what I've been talking about, one resource. Think now of an environment of a billion, well, maybe short term, just to get us started, but billions. Possibly hundreds of billions of resources. It may seem incredible and impossible, but I mean, we've come close to that in just the first few years of blogging. So, I mean, how hard could it be? So, we have this network of resources. These resources are all over the internet. There's a layer of metadata gathered through use of all of these resources. We are seeing this already. Google, with its PageRank technology, grabs information, metadata about resources expressed as links. Technorati and PopDex and Daypop and BlogDex are services oriented specifically toward blogs. They gather information about linkage. TechnoRadi, in addition, as well, Flickr as well has done this, have created systems called tags, where if you see a resource, you associate a word with it. No rules, just whatever word you think is appropriate. The whole point here is just to create the metadata. The use of the metadata will emerge. The point is just capture some kind of description. I think in a learning environment, we can be very fine-grained with this. We can know, for example, that a resource was used in grade 4 math. How do we know? Well, because that's the context in which the resource was used. If we capture some contextual information in passing, we're adding to this layer of metadata. There are systems out there on the internet now under the general heading of recommender systems. That may be a term that's familiar to some of you. And again, what these are mechanisms for collecting and using evaluative metadata, thumbs up, thumbs down measurements. Sites like Amazon.com and eBay use this sort of metadata to great effect, right? People who liked this also liked the grandfather of these systems was a system called Firefly. It was developed in 97 or 98. Firefly came up with two things, actually, the recommender system and the passport, personal identification. Microsoft bought Firefly, killed Firefly, kept passport. I think they kept the wrong part, personally. Yahoo has launched Cast, which again is that sort of thing, creating and capturing metadata through use. So that's the environment. Right? We're used to living and working in a world where we think of learning content as it's being all in its own special place, and this is the learning content, this is special, and then this is all the dregs. But online, it all kind of merges and smooshes together. It's all content. And what makes it learning content is, at some point in this metadata description, there is an inscription that this bit of content was used in learning. So, what we need to do next is develop a system where this information can come to me, the learner. And that process is generally known as aggregation. Let's see if I'll get to a slide I've actually written now. Okay, yeah. Oh, well, there we go. There's what was supposed to be on that slide. So, okay, here's aggregation. Again, image stolen from Scott Wilson. I don't know when he produced it, but I guess it was recently. Here's me, or you, or some student. Here's stuff out there on the web. Music, don't know what that is. Coffee, oh, I can't be coffee. I don't know what that is. A Java cup with an apple on it, and a pencil on a piece of paper. I have no idea what he could have been thinking of. This is why, if you're designing web pages, don't use icons. Use words. Because nobody knows what icons mean. Well, not nobody, but a significant percentage. Well, mainly me. And if you want to support icons, if you think icons is the way to do it, tell me what that means. If you can't tell me what that means, you must commit yourself to using words, not icons, on your websites. Photographs, books, text, whatever. The idea here is to bring them to the learner. Now, we don't want to bring everything to every learner. That's called spam. That's bad. The idea is we need to set up the learning network as a filtering network. And I call this, when I talk about this, the self-organizing network. I have more pictures. Here, using current technology, and this diagram is kind of morphing over time, is what it looks like now, where we're at now. And I say we, because there's a group of people out there who are working on this vision. So here's the future, you can tell Scott Wilson did this, you get the British terminology here. Future virtual learning environment. Right? There's now LiveJournal is a blogging site that feeds in Dealer Direct's ePortfolio, that feeds in personal hosting, Flickr, which is your image site, some sort of alert system there. All the educational technologists put alert stuff in. I don't know. You never see it anywhere else, but there it is. Bolton Institute, I guess that's some college or something. 43 things, which actually will eventually disappear from this diagram because it turned out to be kind of like a commercial front, but we'll leave that aside. This little writing here are the protocols that are used to enable these sites to communicate with this learning environment. How do I want to put this? See, it's not well expressed in this diagram, but all of these resources are described using metadata. You have a central site, or actually you have a whole network of central sites, not represented here, that bring in or harvest this metadata. Think the way Google harvests web pages. Think of services that go out there looking specifically for metadata. So what they do is they gather all the metadata associated with a given object. Then you have a person who accesses one of these sites and asks for a filtered subset of all of the resources that have been harvested. In a sense, it's like going to Google and doing a search, except all the work goes the other way. It's more like a subscription than a search. I've set up a system some of you may have seen called EduRSS. EduRSS is an instance of this. It actually works. It's been working for about a year now. EduRSS harvests metadata from blogs and newspapers and magazines and things like that. This metadata is written in a format called RSS. The reason why RSS is used, it stands for Rich Site Summary. It's a very simple form of metadata. Title, link, description. That's all you need to make RSS work. Now, if you want, you can extend it. RSS, for example, will support Dublin Core tags. So you can put creator in there. You can put publisher in there. You can put date in there. And you're not required to. So the thing with RSS is anybody can use it. It's so simple. I wrote an article a couple of years ago, how to create an RSS feed with a website, Notepad, and a beer. And it turns out that Notepad is optional. Well, I got some chuckles out of that. So, this metadata, now, the way EduRSS works, that's a bit different from Google or Technoradio or the others, I don't try to harvest everything. I just harvest sites directly related to educational technology. I bring that in, put them all together, and then sort them out into a list of 107 topics. Thank you. You now can come to EduRSS. You can see the 107 topics, or if you like, you know, fountains or rivers of information, you just choose everything. But you can pick, say, learning objects. You click on learning objects, and then you can get your own custom RSS feed that contains all and only the items written about learning objects from those sites that EduRSS harvests. And feed that into your own web page or your email or wherever you want it to go. That exists now. And that's how this works. That's how you get what I call the self-organizing network. Right now, there's only one EduRSS, kind of limited. I'm working on a version 2, which will bring in more functionality, but I'm more interested in watching for other instances of things like EduRSS. And we've got things like PubSub and TechnoReady that harvest everything. But I'm more interested in the services that harvest just some things, because that allows us to get very finely grained categorizations, categorizations that are personally relevant to individuals rather than relevant to entire sectors of individuals. But if you go to my website, you can actually go look at EduRSS and see it working and actually see the learning object field. It's if you click under EduRSS topics, that's where you'll find it. Those feeds, feeds like EduRSS, are what feed into this. In EduRSS 0.2, which I'm working on right now, in addition to metadata produced by the creator of the object, I am also bringing in metadata produced by commentators of the object. I'm bringing in evaluative, thumbs up, thumbs down kind of metadata. I'm bringing in use metadata, like click rates and things like that, linkage rates. So I'm going to be pulling in a wider range of metadata. I'm still focused specifically on the one little community of educational writers, but now I'm getting a more diverse type of information. Now, instead of simply saying learning objects, you can have learning objects written by people who have written articles that are rated higher than 5 out of 10 by Friends of Stephen. Now, maybe I'll finish that, maybe I won't. That will come. It's coming now. You may have heard of the whole talk about social networking and all that. If you look up social networking through Google, you'll see a pile of results. All of that is coming and bringing this together. So when I describe subscription feeds like the one I just described there, this is a virtual certainty. I mean, it would take like end of the world phenomena to prevent this from happening. It is going to happen. So we are within 2 or 3 years of having an incredibly functional, versatile, and personalized learning environment that can draw resources from a wide range of sources. The task for educational designers today is not to be designing courses and programs, although your managers will continue to tell you to do that, which means you have to go guerrilla. The task is to start designing entities that will be standalone enough to feed into this kind of virtual learning environment.
How do you see that kind of virtual learning becoming aware of new sources of information?
Well, it's like, how does the world become aware of a baby? You know, there's a notice in the newspaper, and that gets, you know, the readership includes the baby's parents, and, well, that's about it. But, you know, it happens gradually. It happens, but you do. I mean, all of these services have, you know, the latest such and such. Like Merlot, which is a repository of learning objects, has an RSS feed, latest Merlot objects. Right? There will be people, because there are always people like this, who scan that feed and who give these things a thumbs up or a thumbs down or whatever. Why? Because they want to be the trendsetters. They want to be the ones to pick the winners, right? Now, one person's thumb up or thumb down pretty meaningless in the grand scheme of things. But, you know, I mean, it's an initial separation. And it snowballs from there, right? One person gives it a thumbs up. That gives it 10 reads and a link. And that attracts a few more. And so it continues.
Do you sort of see these virtual learning labs becoming self-aware of larger repositories based on, again, usage?
Short answer is yes. long answer is we really need to define what we mean by self-aware. But yes. And also too, like, so far I've been describing what could be described as a single layer of the network, right? Producer, aggregator, user. You take that single layer, add more layers, and you get a lattice structure. And this lattice structure, we know because it's been modeled mathematically, is capable of self-organization. And so that's where you get the awareness of resources. Keeping in mind, most resources are junk. Just as when you look around the room, most of what you see is junk. I'm looking around this room, there's about 100 tiles on the ceiling, there's about, looks like 18 lights and so on. None of this information registered to me because it's completely irrelevant. But information, all of that information, the green wall over there, the coffee that I'm going to have in a few minutes, a fire extinguisher, all of that comes in, but it goes through this filtering process, the structure of which is exactly the same as the structure I'm describing for this network. It's not simply similar, it's the same. And that process creates a filtering, and it allows me to highlight relevant information. Being a person, I'll probably highlight things that are similar to me, so the main thing that I pick out when I'm looking around this room are your faces. I don't do it very well, which means I'll probably forget your names, but other people do it better than I do. And then as things change, if there were a fire, I would suddenly be really interested in the fire alarm, which just was in the background of my consciousness. It varies according to context. It varies according to circumstance. It's what allows this sort of dynamic classification. You don't need to build entire engines to send exactly the right resources to your fishing rod. You just need to build a network of the appropriate structure, and the resources of their own accord will end up in your fishing rod. No magic to it.
But it's my sense based on this that you're not learning the content. It's more important for people to learn how to learn than learning the content. So they can then filter through all of this information,
sure,
or all of this network to see what it is they really want without taking 2 weeks
yeah
to do it.
Yeah, see, here's, I don't know how to say it, but the idea here is to acquire the capacity to immerse yourself and be a part of this network. If that makes sense. I'm trying to do this without being mystical. But, I mean, because you're absolutely right. The concept of memorizing content doesn't make a whole lot of sense. There is memorization of content. Otherwise, we would die. But the mechanism, the process for how to memorize content is, in this picture, more through use, more through repetition. It's your teaching rod telling you how to fish 10 or 20 times, and it sinks in. It's learning a pedagogy designed specifically according to principles of associationist learning. And the reason why that fits here is that the mechanism for the organization of learning materials is associationist filtering. So if you set up learning in such a way as to, I don't know how to say it right. Is what I've said so far made sense?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I don't have the right string of words, have the right picture. Problem
I don't
is
think
it's
created them yet.
Well, but the information is out there. I started the talk with philosophy. I'll end it with philosophy because I'm coming toward a conclusion here. If you look at, the other side of Plato, the other side of Plato's probably most famous follower, Elohim and I have to leave that aside, Descartes. The other side of that is the world of Protagoras and the world of people like David Hume. Plato says there are ideals. Protagoras, Hume say that people are the measure of all things. The learning, according to Hume, and I think this is quite right, develops as a consequence of repeated exposure to similar phenomena. I once wrote a paper titled, Could Hume Play Billiards? And the answer was yes, but he would have to practice. In philosophy, that's called significant discovery. I'm just kidding. But the mechanisms, now Hume expressed this in terms of things like custom and habit, right? We come to believe in cause and effect through custom and habit. Since Hume, though, we've come to understand what might be called associationist logic a bit more fully. Donald Hebb, who's a Canadian psychologist, has an associationist principle of learning. And the principle is fairly simple. Take two neurons, any two neurons. If they both fire off at the same time and don't fire off at the same time, draw a connection between them. And that mechanism for creating links between individual units creates what might be called cognitive networks. It's that mechanism underlying the learning network that I'm trying to describe. And if we use that mechanism explicitly when designing learning opportunities, then what we're trying to do is create situations in which people can have experiences that will create the associations similar to associations that exist in areas of knowledge we think they ought to learn. There's a phrasing. Oh, I'm glad I recorded that. But in other words, the idea here is instead of trying to take content and put it into people's head where it won't stick, the idea is to recreate in the person the experiences that have been had by somebody who already knows what it is that you want to teach the person. And that's the model I'm after. And that's why I think learning by immersion, learning as in the model of the Living Arts Center, is the sort of model that we want to get to, and why, to me, it's so important to get out of the classroom. This model is how we do it. We build this network. And we build this network in the same sort of structure as the learning network that we're trying to teach. And that's the story. And I can go into, at this point, right, we start talking, okay, what does one of these look like? And I draw you a whole bunch of squiggles. And we talk about, okay, how does this talk to this? How does this talk to this? What kind of protocols do you use? And we can get into an awful lot of squiggles in a hurry. And if you follow my website, you'll get from time to time the sort of broad stroke stuff like I did today, and you get from time to time detailed excursions into little bits and pieces of this diagram. And I think that's everything that I want to say today. And I certainly appreciate all of your patience in staying this long. And I'm quite surprised by that, because I would have been out of here. Unless there's any other comments or questions. That was, by the way, the last slide. Oh, and that's my website. It was on the last slide.
I'm sure even you could ask Stephen questions after the session itself. I'm sure he's very open to speaking about these issues.
But oh, sure.
Let me assume the role of bringing the session to a close. And I'd like to do that by, first of all, thanking all of you who've attended the session, because I suppose without all of you, Stephen would again be speaking to an empty room. So thank you for all for coming. I should also thank those who organized the session. First, I think we should thank Virginia for hosting the session. Mike,
micromanaging to corral Stephen and getting him up here and all the organizational activities you were involved in. And I think also the logistics of it all, Richard Louette, who set up the room itself and made sure coffee was available. And last but not least, I'd like to extend my appreciation to Stephen Downs for joining us. I know you have a very, very busy schedule, and you provided us with a most lucid presentation and a very thought-provoking presentation. So on behalf of all of us, I would like to thank you for joining us and sharing your ideas with us.
Thank you. And we'll say bye to everybody who's been listening online, or who will be listening online.